Welcome to the Verity Podcast for Tuesday, April 2nd, 2024, where we separate the spin from the facts. I'm Scott Wallace.
And I'm Eric Steiner. Here's a look at today's top stories. Israeli troops withdraw from Gaza's Al-Shifa Hospital.
While Israel experiences its largest protest since October 7th.
60 Minutes and other outlets allege a Russian tie to Havana Syndrome.
A key Haitian gang leader demands a role in peace talks.
Turkey's opposition party wins a plurality in local elections.
Senegal's top court confirms Diomaye Faye as president-elect.
The Biden and Trump camps spar as Transgender Visibility Day falls on Easter.
A temporary maritime channel is announced in the port of Baltimore.
South Korea's president calls striking doctors a cartel.
And bird flu is detected in U.S. dairy cows for the first time.
In our top story, Israeli troops withdraw from Gaza's Al-Shifa Hospital. The facts are agreed upon by BBC News, Associated Press, Washington Post, and WION. Following a two-week raid, Israeli forces withdrew from the Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City on Monday. In a statement following the withdrawal, Israeli Defense Forces, or IDF, said they exited the compound after a precise operation that killed terrorists and found numerous weapons and intelligence documents, while claiming to prevent harm to civilians, patients, and medical teams. However, images and videos of the hospital, already out of service after previous Israeli attacks, showed it charred and heavily damaged. Health officials in Gaza also rejected Israel's assertions that the hospital was used by Hamas fighters for military purposes. A number of previous investigations, including by Guardian, The Washington Post, and Al Jazeera, have concluded that the evidence falls short of showing that Hamas has used the hospital as a headquarters or to stage attacks. Following the Israeli withdrawal, the Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry said that the bodies of dozens of civilians, some of them decomposed, have been recovered from in and around the Al-Shifa Hospital. It added that the complex was set on fire after the Israeli exit, leaving it completely out of service.
All right. Thanks for that update, Eric. We have some contrasting narrative spins on this story, starting with the pro-Israel narrative from Jerusalem Post. Israel has withdrawn from the Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza after a successful operation in which Israeli troops killed and captured many Palestinian terrorists. Numerous weapons and intelligence documents were also seized from the site.
Follow that with a pro-Palestine narrative coming from WION. Despite Israel's allegations, there's no evidence the Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza was being used by Hamas fighters. These are lies spread by Israel in an attempt to justify war crimes.
And a nerd narrative from the Metaculous Prediction community. They predict a 50% chance there will be at least 50,000 Palestinian civilian deaths in the Israel-Gaza conflict before July 1st, 2024. Israel sees its largest anti-government protest since the October 7th attack. Here are the facts on this story as agreed upon by PBS NewsHour, Jerusalem Post, Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, CNN, and The Times of Israel. Tens of thousands of Israelis gathered outside the Knesset in Jerusalem on Sunday to start a four-day demonstration against the government, marking the largest protest in the country since Hamas's October 7th attack. The demonstrations come as the unity following Hamas's attack seemingly erodes after nearly 6 months of war, with opposition leader Yair Lapid energetically criticizing the government while speaking at the rally. On Monday, demonstrators pitched hundreds of tents outside the parliament building as they called for early elections and renewed efforts to bring hostages held in Gaza back to Israel. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu reasserted in a television speech on Sunday that he would do anything to secure the hostages' release, but claimed that new elections would paralyze the country and hostage negotiations for 6 to 8 months. Over 100 hostages were freed in November, but another 100 remain in Gaza, though it's unclear how many are still alive. Negotiations have repeatedly stalled, with the presence of Israeli forces in Gaza being one of the primary sticking points. Polls consistently indicate that the ruling coalition, which faces a concurrent political crisis over plans to draft young, ultra-Orthodox Israelis into the military, has lost ground and would unlikely remain in power in the event of a new election.
Scott, thanks for the facts of that story. Our first spin is a right narrative. It's coming from the Jewish News Syndicate. While some Israelis have rallied in good faith to demonstrate the need for an immediate solution to bring the hostages back home, it's outrageous that the opposition is now cynically using the hostage situation as a pretext to oust Netanyahu. In a short-sighted attempt to achieve short-term political goals, these anti-Netanyahu protests effectively undermine the Israeli negotiating position in talks with Hamas.
Haaretz brings us a left narrative spin. Netanyahu failed to prevent Hamas's October 7th massacre, and his military strategy has failed to effectively return the hostages, though Israeli is fighting its weakest enemy ever. A besieged militant group of just a few thousand fighters, the government has managed to conduct the country's most unsuccessful military campaign. Now Israel has been left isolated and soon to be bankrupt. Netanyahu must go as soon as possible.
The Metaculous Prediction Community has a nerd narrative for this story. They say there's a 40% chance that Benjamin Netanyahu will remain Prime Minister of Israel throughout this year. Russia possibly is behind the Havana Syndrome. Here are the facts as agreed upon by Guardian, Time, BBC News, CBS, and Euronews. A joint investigation by The Insider, Der Spiegel, and the CBS News program 60 Minutes claims Russia may be to blame for U.S. diplomats and other officials suffering a mysterious set of ailments called Havana Syndrome. A report on the years-long investigation aired Sunday. Victims of the reported health incidents allegedly endured symptoms including severe headaches, dizziness, nausea, and ear pain. The incidents are often referred to as Havana Syndrome, as the first documented cases were reported at the U.S. Embassy in Havana, Cuba in 2016. The new report says the first case of the condition may have actually occurred in Germany in 2014, and there have been more than 1,000 reports of mystery ailments that have plagued diplomats all over the world, with dozens still unresolved. 60 Minutes' five-year investigation contradicts a 2023 report by the U.S. government that said it was, quote, very unlikely a foreign adversary was responsible for the mysterious ailments. The 60 Minutes report says it has uncovered evidence that Russia's GRU Unit 29155 may have used directed energy weapons to attack U.S. officials. The intelligence unit has been blamed for other foreign relations, such as the poisoning of a Russian defector in the UK in 2018. Studies of those experiencing Havana Syndrome have reportedly shown no evidence of physical damage. The FBI, White House, and National Intelligence continue to monitor the situation, though their stance hasn't changed since last year. The Kremlin has denied the allegations.
All right, we have an establishment critical narrative on this story from Newsweek. Sunday's report moves beyond circumstantial evidence and makes it all but certain that Moscow is behind Havana Syndrome. Russia has the technology, capability, and motive to deploy non-lethal acoustic weapons to disrupt the U.S. The U.S. government should reopen its investigation immediately and respond with due diligence and greater empathy to civil servants who have suffered through this attack and subsequent neglect.
And CBS comes back with a pro-establishment narrative. The U.S. government has studied the allegations of Havana Syndrome in detail. These outcomes of this investigation have not established causality between reported symptoms and a foreign adversary. Government agencies are concerned about reported symptoms, and their personnel will explore holistic solutions and employee well-being to enhance occupational health and safety.
And we have a pro-Russian narrative from TASS. This report is just more fear-mongering by the U.S. against Russia. Whenever any person or official in the U.S. suffers from any ailment, the American media and some government officials quickly blame Russia without any evidence. This silliness needs to end, and the Kremlin will continue to push back against baseless accusations.
And the nerds say there's a 13% chance that there will be a war between the U.S. and Russia before January 1st, 2050. And that comes from Metaculous.
A Haitian gang leader demands a role in peace talks. Here are the facts, as agreed upon by NBC, Sky News, BBC News, The Haitian Times, Al Jazeera, and the Associated Press. Jimmy Barbecue Cherizier, the head of both the G9 Federation of Gangs and the newly formed Vive Ensemble Revolutionary Gang Alliance, has stated that the inclusion of him and his allies in talks about Haiti's future is an indispensable precondition for a ceasefire. In an interview with Sky News published during the Easter holidays, the gang leader also stressed, amid plans for a Kenya-led peacekeeping mission in Haiti, that foreign forces will be considered aggressors and invaders. The violence that has engulfed the Caribbean nation, home to 11 million people in the past week, could increase soon. Cherizier claimed this while adding that he and his allies, who are in control of most of Port-au-Prince, are ready for solutions. This comes as the Caribbean Community, or CARICOM, has urged the outgoing Prime Minister Ariel Henry to immediately install the Transitional Presidential Council to resolve the political crisis in the country. According to a recent report by the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Haiti needs up to 5,000 international police personnel to tackle what has been described as a catastrophic situation in the country. The report claims also that while 4,451 people were killed as a result of gang violence in the country last year, the figure was at 1,554 by March 22nd this year, with estimates that hundreds of thousands have been displaced and nearly 1.5 million on the brink of famine.
Scott, thank you for the facts. The first spin for this story is a pro-establishment narrative coming from Foreign Policy. More than just powerful gangsters, Cherizier and his allies are armed insurgents that have threatened civil war and genocide unless their political goals are met. Given that Haiti is a failed state and its government has lost authority, only an international military intervention to neutralize enemy combatants can restore order in the volatile Caribbean nation.
And the Washington Post brings us the establishment critical narrative. Though Cherizier represents the very armed gangs that are to blame for the chaos in Haiti, his words against foreign troops in the country reflect the view of ordinary Haitians. The country has a long and ugly history of international intervention that ended in failure and made life even worse.
And the nerds from Metaculous have a nerd narrative saying there's a 67% chance that Haiti will experience a successful coup d'etat before 2040. The Turkish opposition party wins plurality in the local elections. Here are the facts as agreed upon by CNBC, New York Times, Politico, Reuters, and NPR Online News. Turkey's leading opposition party, the Republican People's Party, or CHP, made significant gains against President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's ruling Justice and Development Party, or AKP, in local elections held over the weekend. The CHP won 37.8% of the vote, its highest share since 1977, while the AKP only won 35.5%, its worst showing in local elections since the party was founded over 20 years ago. Erdogan acknowledged his party's losses, calling them a, quote, turning point. The CHP managed to hold on to or gain the country's five biggest cities, including Istanbul, in which the CHP candidate was re-elected as mayor. The CHP also claimed victories in Ankara, Adana, Bursa, and Izmir. The AKP did manage to flip Hatay, a formerly opposition-held major city in southern Turkey near the Syrian border, which was heavily damaged by devastating earthquakes last year that killed more than 53,000 people. Turkey's economy has seen an inflation rate of almost 70% and slow growth. Erdogan has preferred aggressive economic policies, with his finance minister saying on Monday that Turkey is working toward reducing inflation and achieving sustainable growth. Though the CHP made solid gains, the AKP still enjoys large contingents of support across the country, with turnout being down by over 10% compared to last year. The AKP is also still the ruling party, as it won presidential and parliamentary elections the past May.
Thanks, Eric. We have some opposing narratives on this story as well, starting with narrative A from Daily Sabah. Every citizen of Turkey should feel proud that they live in an energetic and pluralistic democracy in which the people can tell those in power how they feel and express their grievances with the state. President Erdogan, throughout his tenure, has consistently demonstrated his desire to listen to the Turkish people and enact their wishes. This election, though certainly a turning point for the AKP, is by no means the end. The AKP will reflect on this election and continue working toward the interests of the Turkish people.
Follow that up with narrative B coming from Guardian. Erdogan is correct in celebrating Turkish democracy. However, he should be feeling a lot of pressure as his grip on power begins to loosen. Erdogan has consistently demonstrated his desire to subvert Turkish democracy for his own financial and political interests. Though he may be an authoritarian, Erdogan is not a dictator, and the Turkish opposition should now feel a new surge of energy moving forward. With coordination and will, Erdogan can be ousted and Turkey's democracy renewed.
And a nerd narrative from Metaculus. There's a 7% chance that Turkey will be a member of the EU by 2040. Senegal's top court confirms Demoye Faye as president-elect. Here are the facts on this story as agreed upon by Africa News, Reuters, Xinhua, Al Jazeera, and The Guardian. Senegal's Constitutional Council has confirmed opposition candidate Bassirou Demoye Faye's presidential election victory. The 44-year-old is due to be sworn in on Tuesday. The country's top court on Friday validated provisional results released earlier in the week based on vote tallies from polling stations. Faye received 54.28% of the votes, while his closest rival, the ruling coalition candidate Amadou Ba, took about 35.79%, with voter turnout at around 61%. Released from prison less than 10 days before the vote, he emerged as a strong candidate after his ally and disqualified opposition leader Ousmane Sonko endorsed him to run in his place. This is the first time that an opposition candidate has won the presidential election in the first round of voting since Senegal gained independence from France in 1960.
Scott, thanks for the facts. The first spin is narrative A coming from Democracy Now! that the Senegalese people were able to elect an opposition leader imprisoned just days before the election is an impressive surprise, especially after all the attempts for the outgoing president to cling to power behind his constitutional term, including postponing the vote. His victory is a triumph for the country and its democratic system.
And narrative B comes from The Economist. Senegal has again demonstrated its democratic stability, despite the scaremongering that preceded the vote. However, the nation has chosen a new president that, similar to new coup leaders in neighboring countries, represents a populist reaction to regional problems. It's unclear whether this vote for rupture will be the right choice for the country's future.
There's a nerd narrative as well. They say there's a 15% chance that Senegal will experience a successful coup d'etat before 2040. In the next story, Transgender Day of Visibility lands on Easter. Here are the facts as agreed upon by Al Jazeera, the White House, Associated Press, Newsweek, Daily Wire, and The Hill. This year, the U.S. Transgender Day of Visibility fell on Easter Sunday, causing a backlash over the coincidence and President Joe Biden's recognition of it from conservatives and former President Donald Trump's presidential campaign. In a proclamation issued Friday, Biden called on all Americans to join us in lifting up the lives and voices of transgender people across the country and to aid in eliminating violence and discrimination against them. A Trump campaign spokeswoman accused the White House of what she called a, quote, years-long assault on the Christian faith. The Transgender Day of Visibility was created by advocates in 2009 and is celebrated annually on March 31st. Biden was the first U.S. president to proclaim it as an official day of transgender visibility in 2021. The White House also stated that all trans Americans are made in the image of God, to which several conservatives sent replies ranging from Bible quotes to questioning why people made by God would need surgeries and hormones. A White House spokesman argued that politicians are seeking to divide and weaken the U.S. with cruel, hateful, and dishonest rhetoric, also noting that Biden is a Christian who celebrates Easter with family and would never abuse his faith for political purposes.
All right, I'm sure you won't be surprised, Eric. We have some very opposing viewpoints on this story. The right narrative spin comes from PJ Media. Once again, Biden and the left have shown their disdain for religion and revealed themselves to be worshippers of identity politics instead. Biden only pretends to be religious when he needs to be, when he needs it to court actual Christians' votes. The president made this unfortunate confluence on one of the holiest Christian days of the year with a made-up political stunt, worse, by issuing his proclamation on Good Friday.
Follow that with a left narrative coming from Advocate. It may surprise those on the right who are drumming up this faux controversy, but there are many LGBTQ plus Christians and allies who, like Biden, recognize both Easter and the Transgender Day of Visibility. It's shameful that there are Christians on the right using a coincidence on the calendar to attack the president and overshadow the hope and joy Easter represents.
And a nerd narrative from Attaculus, there's a 52% chance that if the 2024 U.S. presidential election is Trump versus Biden, Trump will win. A temporary channel is announced amid Baltimore Bridge rebuilding plans. The facts on this story are agreed upon by Forbes, Reuters, Bloomberg, The Daily Caller, CBS, and The New York Post. On Sunday, the unified command of federal and state officials responding to the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge announced that a temporary channel would be established to support maritime traffic access to the Port of Baltimore. This comes as the U.S. Department of Transportation has approved a request from Maryland Governor Wes Moore for $60 million in emergency funds to clear debris and start rebuilding Baltimore's collapsed Francis Scott Key Bridge. According to the federal agency, the debris disbursement will serve as a down payment toward initial costs, and further resources will follow as the project continues. The multi-million dollar relief fund to deal with the Baltimore Bridge collision isn't tied specifically to the reconstruction of the bridge itself, as President Joe Biden has already pledged full federal financial support for this. Last Friday, heavy equipment began arriving in Baltimore to remove what remains of the bridge, as well as to refloat and move the Dolly cargo ship that hit it last Tuesday. Insured losses in connection with this deadly collapse are estimated to be the largest marine insurance loss ever, up to $4 billion, due to suspended operations in the Port of Baltimore, liabilities, the Dolly's cargo, and the overall property damage.
Scott, thanks for the facts. We're going to look at the spins, and the first one is a Democratic narrative coming from CNN. The Biden administration is right to allocate significant federal resources to reopen the critical port of Baltimore and rebuild the bridge as soon as possible. These efforts wouldn't be without precedent, as the federal government has previously released millions in similar incidents in Minnesota in 2007 and in Philadelphia last year.
And the Republican narrative comes from Blaze Media. It's outrageous that the very first and so far the only reaction from the Biden administration is to force American taxpayers to pay for yet another rebuilding project as if there were no other alternatives. The White House should instead try to have Singapore and insurance companies help finance the project, as well as to reappropriate unused money.
The nerds from Attaculous say there's a 50% chance that the U.S. national debt will reach $50 trillion by January of 2030. The South Korean president calls striking doctors a cartel. Here are the facts as agreed upon by Al Jazeera, Korea Times, Barron's, Halkirae, and The Straits Times. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol reiterated his desire to increase annual medical school admissions by 2,000, and he went on to accuse the doctors in the ongoing strike against the proposal of being a, quote, cartel. Yoon said the 2,000 figure was not a random figure we came up with, but rather an essential policy to combat shortages and treat a fast-aging society. Since thousands of doctors in training walked off the job on February 20th, hospitals have had to cancel surgeries and other important treatments. In response, the government has threatened to suspend their medical licenses. On Monday, medical professors and private practice doctors also announced that they'll begin a new, quote, law-abiding protest by reducing their hours to the mandatory minimum of 40 per week. Yoon said past government attempts to increase admissions failed repeatedly, with the so-called cartel of doctors being strengthened each time. He called on doctors to articulate a blueprint with clear scientific reasoning rather than striking. While the public initially supported the government's plan, new polls suggest that 60% of respondents believe Yoon should make changes to the original proposal.
Halkirae brings us Narrative A. South Korean doctors have pulled these schemes for decades, and the government never punishes them. Despite a visible decline in medical personnel, hospital leaders and medical school professors never hold students accountable for breaking the law. Whether the government proposes an admissions increase of 2,000 or 500, the medical establishment enjoys its elite status too much to prioritize patients over their desires.
Narrative B comes from Medium. This strike is not just over admissions rates, but rather a response to deeper issues with the national healthcare system. Despite life expectancy and the economy growing, the government has not increased compensation for doctors working at national hospitals. This has led to an exodus from medical care and toward cosmetic fields. If the government gave the pool of quality doctors the resources, there would be more health providers across the country.
And a nerd narrative from Attaculous, there's a 50% chance that South Korea's fertility rate will be at least 0.69 in 2032. Our final story, U.S. dairy cows contract bird flu for the first time. Here are the facts as agreed upon by CBS, NPR Online News, The Guardian, and the Texas Tribune. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, Food and Drug Administration, and Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announced that cattle from farms in Kansas and Texas had tested positive for highly pathogenic avian influenza, the first time the virus has been detected in cattle. The virus was later detected in a herd in Michigan that had recently received cows from Texas. Officials have also said presumptive positive test results have been received from herds in New Mexico and Idaho. Bird flu, which infects the respiratory and gastrointestinal tracts of birds, is highly fatal for avian populations. The virus can be transmitted from wild birds to commercial poultry populations, as well as to mammals, including humans. The U.S. government said there is no concern about the safety of the commercial milk supply or that this circumstance poses a risk to consumer health. Only milk from healthy cows is permitted to enter the food supply chain, and milk from sick cows is being diverted and destroyed. Officials believe the virus was likely introduced to the cows by wild birds at affected farms, though they have not ruled out cow-to-cow transmission. Texas officials Monday said a person who had contact with infected cattle has tested positive for bird flu. Clinicians in the state have been recommended to consider the possibility of the virus in people via exposure to animals and unpasteurized milk from affected farms.
Scott, thank you for the interesting facts. The first spin is Narrative A coming from CBS News. This outbreak should not be a cause for alarm in humans. Scientists haven't found any evidence that this strain has changed in terms of making it easier to transmit to humans, indicating that the risk is low. Additionally, regulations for commercial dairy products ensure that pasteurized milk is safe for consumption.
Narrative B comes from the WHO. Recent cases of bird flu in mammals are extremely worrying because they may suggest a mutation that's making it easier to transmit to humans. Additionally, multiple types of influenza viruses could potentially intermix within infected animals and create new viruses that could be even more harmful to mammals. This situation and food supply chains must be monitored extremely closely.
The nerds say there's a 5% chance that there will be a novel pathogen that kills over 25 million people between 2022 and 2031. Thanks for listening to the Verity Podcast for Tuesday, April 2nd, 2024.
Each day, we use machine learning to read about 5,000 articles from about 100 newspapers to figure out which ones are about the same stories. For each major story, our editorial team then extracts both the key facts that all articles agree on and the key narratives where the articles differ.
You can find out more at verity.news. Download the Verity app on the Apple App Store or Google Play. For Scott Wallace, I'm Eric Steiner, inviting you to join us next time on the Verity Podcast.